Your first contact with Arthur Burns was during the 1968 election?
No. I first ran into Arthur Burns when I was a professor at Columbia University. And he was a professor there, too. He was in the economics department, and I was over at the Graduate School of Business, Columbia.
And so what year was that?
Oh, I forget exactly what year I met him, but I went to Columbia in fall of 1962, and I stayed there until I left during the campaign in 1968.
So you were a colleague of
Burns? Colleague, yeah, except that I was in the Graduate School of Business and he was in the Economics Department. Mm-hmm. As is probably true in most universities, they rarely speak to each other. So I forget how I met him. It may have been when Milton Friedman was visiting there for a year. I remember
64?
Yeah, and it may have been during that. I forget the exact year I met, but I did get to know him while I was at Columbia. Mm-hmm. I didn't spend a lot of time with him. I knew he was.
And what was your role in the campaign, the Nixon campaign?
I was director of policy research.
You were involved in the policy of gradualism, the macroeconomic policy of bringing inflation down without causing unemployment to rise significantly.
We didn't have that policy in the campaign.
Okay.
I don't remember. I don't think that was something the council put together at that time.
No, it wasn't. Okay. One thing.
Basically, what happened in the campaign was that we had sort of a troika that ran the policy shop in New York. And then when the campaign started off, we were really flying around. I went out on the airplane with Nixon and traveled with him and coordinated the policy with the speechwriters and the candidate. And then back in New York, the foreign policy defense stuff was coordinated by Richard Allen. Mm-hmm. And the domestic economic stuff by Alan Greenspan. Which is a fact of history that everyone seems to have overlooked.
Yes, and Greenspan was involved in the 72 campaign also. I got a letter that I found in the files where Greenspan volunteered to speak out on issues as an independent source on issues that were critical to the campaign. I mean, the idea was that they would be given publicity, but in fact, behind the scenes, he would be in communication with
them. I think that's actually relatively minor to what he did in 68, because, first of all, tremendous difference. The campaign of 68 was, this Richard Nixon running as a really long shot, Democratic registration 2-1 against him, trying to take power for the first time in many years. Whereas in 72, he's running as an incumbent. So that's a very, very different business.
I'm sure I'm recording. I think I'm okay. There was an incident in the campaign where a campaign was asked what was the difference between Humphrey and Nixon on unemployment, and the campaign aide said that gave a response which suggested that Nixon would be more concerned about inflation than unemployment, and Arthur Burns was brought in and told the account to newspaper reporters of how concerned Nixon was in 59-60 about unemployment, and that Nixon was not at all indifferent to unemployment. Does that ring a bell, that event?
Who was the aide?
This is a story I read in Sapphire's book.
Oh.
And it didn't mention the aide, but it mentioned this. It was in how Burns was brought into the campaign.
That's not the way Burns was used in the campaign. I assume that happened. That's a very minor point.
Okay.
Basically, what I recall happening is that when the campaign took off and we started campaigning, it wasn't the normal thing of having the staff say to the candidate, you really ought to talk to Arthur Burns. He was very familiar with Arthur Burns. Richard Nixon had enormous respect for him that he got while he was serving as vice president and Arthur was serving as chairman of the council for Eisenhower. And basically, I guess all parties concerned in Johnson can tell the truth about what happened. Basically, Richard Nixon had an enormous amount of respect for what Arthur Burns said and what his recommendations were. Mm-hmm. But he was impatient because the way Arthur would deal with Richard Nixon, Arthur treated him like a good young fellow that was coming along nicely, which drove Nixon a little crazy. Yeah. And then he would, as he often did, and most people in politics, when you're briefing a candidate or a president, you take the first 10 seconds, you tell them the important stuff, and then you tell them why. Well, Arthur didn't operate that way. He would sit down and he would puff his pipe and he would leisurely instruct Richard Nixon and very gradually move into what the recommendation was, which might be 20 minutes, 30, 40 minutes later. And so I remember one day Richard Nixon basically said to me, look, Arthur's terrific. I like him a lot. He's a wonderful man, great advice, etc., etc. But I can't stand, sit and listen to him. He says, you call him, you listen to him, and then give me the summary. So I did a lot of that.
And so this was during the campaign, or this was...
This was during the campaign, when things are very, hectic, and you rarely get to talk to anybody for more than 3 or 4 minutes at a time. So basically that, and so Arthur was an important part. Then, if I recall correctly, and I've got some files on it somewhere here, one of the things that we did later on was to set up a whole series of task forces, policy task forces, and Arthur was very instrumental in that, recommending the people and things came together. And then the other thing I remember about the campaign, let's see if I get this straight now. Nixon had a lot of confidence in what Burns told him. In fact, that's how Richard Nixon came to know George Shultz. After he had won the election, during the transition, there was one meeting in the Pierre Hotel, and they were looking for a nominee for Secretary of Labor, and Bryce Harlow was at the meeting, Nixon, and Arthur came out. I was there for some reason, I think there were 4 or 5 of us in the room, and Arthur was the one who recommended to Nixon that there was this very sharp young fellow, I think the way you call him, at the University of Chicago, who had experience in labor negotiations, etc., etc., etc. And he's George Shultz, and that's where the name was put in. After Nixon was elected, we got a special assignment from Nixon was to go over to the... He was in the Pierre Hotel, I think it was the Drake Hotel, we had our own little headquarters. And I was functioning as Burns' deputy then. You know, we had 3 or 4 other people working with us in the policy research area. And, oh, Brenda?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So as special assistant, were you involved in economic issues, well, or what were you primarily?
Yeah, before we get there, wonderful. Going into the transition, because I think this is an interesting thing about what Arthur did. Yeah. We went over and basically we had the mission or the charge from Nixon to go through all the policies developing in campaign, everything he had said, everything was in the platform and so on, and put together in one notebook a cohesive program and plan for what all his domestic and economic policies should be. And I was Burns' deputy in that, and I've been working with him. So we went over, and this is the book which resulted from that. This is, I think, the only copy of this, as I stand here. And this is the report submitted to President-elect Nixon by Burns, categorized by all these various issues. And I think the underlinings are Nixon's underlinings. Copy of it.
I've just gotten started on the Nixon administration. Would you be willing to give me sort of a roadmap of who were the main individuals initially trying to set the economic agenda, being the ones who sure. write the position papers for Nixon, and tell me something about the forcefulness of their personalities and also how they interacted with the gatekeepers, Haldeman and Ehrlichman, in terms of getting... It seems relatively straightforward in the prior administrations, but all of a sudden you come to the Nixon administration and you're reading memos, and you're getting memos on economic matters from all different kinds of places and all different
individuals. You always do in all administrations.
That's right. But before then, it seemed pretty clear in the Kennedy administration that the Treasury was the dominant source of influence, and then in the Johnson administration, it's the Council of Economic Advisers. But in the Nixon administration, it seems like advice is coming from all different sorts of quarters. And from labor, for example, with Schultz, that was very unusual for a cabinet person to access.
But I think what you've got to do the Nixon administration was, first of all, 6 years in office.
Mm-hmm.
And 2.5 to 3 months in transition.
Right.
And 1 to 2 years in campaigning.
Right.
And what happens is I would argue that any of the domestic or economic policies, basically they're laid in place during the campaign and the transition. In terms of the general direction. Then when they fool around them a little bit later on, they may change a little bit here and there.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever administration you're talking about, they lay down the campaign. A lot of people come in later on and recommend the same thing, but it's already been done.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to go back to the roots of the campaign. Because I would argue that contrary to conventional wisdom, politicians, almost without exception, do exactly what they say they're going to do. What they promise, mm-hmm. they deliver. And the reason we don't think so is that when they don't, it's big news. We read about mm-hmm. it. But if you go back and track... Oh, here, I'll show you something else. This is here. We did something unusual in 68. We actually published books. These are books. All the positions and issues that Nixon took. And you find it, follows through. Now, here, for example, in these recommendations, his Burns and data January 1869, and there are specific recommendations on policy control board, budget policy, interest reserve, revenue sharing, grant and aid programs, income tax surcharge, tax policy, commission, business. This is all Burns.
Well, give me a specific example. One of the key issues when Burns...
Excuse me a second, let me fix this. Brenda? Okay, good. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
One of the most difficult issues when Burns was elected was what to do about the income tax surcharge, right? Nixon had been critical of it during the campaign, but...
Let's see what he said. I got exactly myself now.
Well, eventually he agreed to go along with it and ask for his extension, and during much of 69 they argued with Congress to try to get it extended. So who would have been the key... at that time, who would have been the key sources of influence? The key people.
When you say at that time, what's
in the 69?
Well, when? I mean, there's a big early in the year is one thing, late in the year is another thing.
How did it fall out in terms of who are the major sources of? I mean, somebody's got to be the one to give the president the memo that says these are the options, these are the choices, and you check.
I disagree on that. That's
okay.
The way it's done in the textbook, and that's true. But it's amazing how many things the president already knows exactly what he is going to do before anyone gives him a memo. And this is a formality, and he's checking things.
Mm-hmm.
But I would argue that. From what I saw, at least during the first year, Institutionally, Secretary of the Treasury is a key advisor. The Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers is a key advisor. The head of the budget, it was then called the Budget Bureau, you know, was in the
Mayo.
He's a key person to budget policy. Early on, the person that dominated all of these in terms of economic policy was Arthur Burns, for two reasons. One, Richard Nixon had a long-term relationship with Arthur Burns. He trusted him. And two, Arthur was the best economist in there. Now, when Paul McCracken got appointed chairman of the council, Burns very deliberately pulled back from pushing economic advice because he didn't want to, he had a great reverence for, you know, the institutional role of the Council of Economic Advisers. You know, and if he had wanted to play bureaucratic games, you know, he could have really dominated, but he didn't. He pulled back. So in that sense, Paul McCracken became an important voice in economic policy, the way it's usually done. But as long as Arthur was on the White House staff, there was the relatively unusual situation where there was a White House economist.
So, Burns had regular access to Nixon in 69.
Yeah, sure. I mean, regular, but he wasn't in and out every day like Haldeman.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, but sure. As one of the, you know, I'd say he had the same kind of access to cabinet personnel. In fact, I believe he had cabinet rank with the council at the time. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think he did.
Okay.
Kennedy didn't seem to have much influence from Treasury. He didn't have a real forceful personality.
No, I don't think it's. Again, I'm a heretic in this. I don't think it's. Anything to do with personality. The basic position, there, I would say, two keys to the effectiveness in the White House. One is information. You have to know what you're talking about, have new information, and at the same time have the, you know, right policy. And two is access. And, you know, if you can have all kinds of ideas, and if you can't get in there, well, Chris Kennedy took, I'm not sure what his ideas were. At least early on, that during that first year, I think President Nixon tended to listen a lot to Arthur Burns. Yeah. Now, not completely. You know, one of the interesting things that I'm describing in Revolution was that if he had followed Arthur's policies, he'd have been a lot better off, but he didn't follow them completely. And I remember the one day where an author was summing up sort of an overall framework. And it was very simple. First, you've got to keep a tight control on federal spending so it doesn't get out of control. And then, in order to continue and stimulate economic growth, he recommended a across-the-board tax cut, 5% a year, for years.
This was in 69.
Which is, in retrospect, I think, I remember during the early Reagan years, some people thought that guys like Arthur Burns and Alan Greenspan were trying to sabotage Reagan's tax policy, but they didn't know that, you know, many years earlier, Arthur Burns was representing the same basic kind of policy, which is a very simple, very fundamental one, which is control spending, lower tax rates systematically, and have a stable, predictable monetary policy. And which, you know, when I went to work for Reagan, we used some of the same ideas, except we took the 5-5-5 and made a 10-10-10.
So tell me again, I should read this in your book, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't know. Which one?
Revolution.
This one.
Okay.
What range of issues were you concerned with? Did you deal with?
Well, that first year in the White House when Arthur Burns was counselor of the president.
Right.
And I was special assistant, but functioned as Arthur's deputy.
So then you put this book together, basically.
Yes.
Okay.
This was during the transition.
Right. Okay, and then these,
campaign.
And then the one you showed me.
And then this was the transition.
Okay. But then Burns put together a series of papers on urban policy and...
Those are task forces. Task force.
Okay.
Then the next step in the White House was that and these should all be in the Nixon Library. After this book was sent to the president, and if he would mark and agree and talk to Arthur and other people, and sometimes it would come from Hall of Earth or whatever, what he wanted to do, then one of the things we did very often was to draft a letter for the president's signature, which would be sent to the relevant cabinet officer, directing Premier Hur to do whatever was in the plan. So this would come back to us, and we would draft the letter, and I would go over, Nixon would read it and check it, sign it, and I would go to a cabinet official, and that would be the policy. And that's how it was set up. And the range was everything in the domestic area, everything across the board, domestic and economic, all policy.
So you must have been heavily involved in the family assistance.
Yes. I wrote a whole book on that. So it's called Welfare. Yes. We spent a major part of the time up until August of 1969 in a really sort of a classic internal battle of the staffs. And the net result was that President Nixon put forth a plan that was unworkable. It was an embarrassment. And Arthur and I told him so. That we were right. We also wasted a good part of the first 8 months, which let the bureaucracy get time to dig in their heels and made it very difficult for Nixon to do things in other areas. The family assistance plan was one of the biggest policy mistakes in the made in modern era.
So you were on the other side for more than that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I thought that was a total. Yeah, okay. Yes. I was number one on his list. And it's a fascinating story as to what happened and how it happened. And, that's a whole different story. But one of the problems was, and why I bring that up, is that it was one of the great lessons that was not repeated when Reagan won. In 1981, we didn't allow that to happen. The only people that came on the White House staff were Ronald Reagan, the people that agreed philosophically with his views and wanted to implement his policies. The time for arguing about what the policy should be was done. That's a campaign. The vote is vote. And so we spent all our time with Ronald Reagan trying to say, how do we get things done? And that's how we got the tax cuts and the spending control and all the other stuff. If we hadn't got involved in that welfare mess, I would argue that we would have spent a lot more time on economic policy and monetary policy.
To what extent did you get involved in monetary policy, the kinds of things the council was concerned with? There were various phases. The initial phase was to try to reduce inflation with a moderate rise in unemployment, and then there was the 1065 where they were going to try to increase the growth rate. And then,
personally, I was not very much, I wasn't involved. If anybody had any questions about monetary policy, we went to Burns. My recollection is that the whole shop, domestic policy shop, which was run by Burns, what I can recall is that our basic attitude was, look, the Fed is an independent organization and it should stay independent. And Arthur had a particular interest because he was interesting as a White House staffer because he had no, if he came on as a counselor with the assurance, then when Martin Stern was up, he would become the Fed chairman. So this was a holding operation.
So, after Burns went to the White House, is your impression that McCracken and the council, along with George Shultz, were the major influences on domestic policy?
On economic policy?
Yeah, I mean economic.
See, what happened as a result of this, coming back, and you almost got to understand the welfare debate because it dominated the domestic side of the White House the first year. And it led to a number of things. It led to the president getting very impatient with his staff fighting and not giving him nice, clean options as to where he could go.
Yeah.
And especially, he wanted to do welfare reform. and it wasn't coming to him. And he disliked welfare workers enormously, and he wanted to cut them down. So one plan would come forth, and Moynihan would say, this will reduce welfare workers. And we would come, Bernstein and I would come in and say, what he says is not true, we were correct. It would not. And finally the president threw up his hands and basically said, look, and he called in Ehrlichman and said, you get this thing straightened out. So by the end of the year, Burns was getting ready to go over the Federal Reserve. John Ehrlichman was de facto in charge of domestic policy. And not that notable an expert in domestic policy. Haldeman was, a very powerful chief of staff, making everything go, all the paperclip go very nicely. And by the late fall, early 1970, Arthur was over in the Federal Reserve. Paul McCracken emerged as the chief economic advisor. Mm-hmm. And because the president liked George Shultz a lot and liked his advice and thought he was a very sound guy and so on, and also the role that he played in trying to resolve some of the issues in the family assistance plan debate, I think he took more of a role. I don't know if people pay that much. Kennedy and Mayo didn't seem to have the normally strong role in the economy. So that's, and then, I'm not sure, I don't really refresh my memory on some of those things, but that's
on the issue of incomes policy that Burns was pushed after he became Fed chairman, how sensitive was the administration to complications with organized labor over that? I mean, was it only the Teamsters Union that supported Nixon politically, or was Nixon concerned about labor in general, about their attitudes and their opposition to controls? And
I don't recall the exact political stuff. I believe it was the Teamsters, but there may have been one other smaller union, but that was the only major union that supported Nixon. It was a very unusual thing.
Mm-hmm.
The income policy debate, I recall there was quite a bit of debate within the White House staff on that. If I recall, refresh my memory
the general situation was that Burns wanted some kind of incomes policy, which was very vague, but basically it was a wage price review board, because in 1970 you got a recession, but the inflation rate didn't respond. So Burns believed that was primarily due to cost push inflation and union power, and Burns wanted Nixon to take on Davis Bacon and be more aggressive with the construction industry and so on. And he had some support within the administration, Romney and Kennedy and Charles Walker at Treasury, but considerable opposition initially from Shultz and Stein, although later on McCracken becomes more...
Stein wasn't there, was he?
Yeah, I think he was there as chairman, but as a member.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry, yeah, okay, yeah.
And it was that, in part that outspokenness that caused a lot of friction between Burns and the White House, because it was the Democrats who were saying that Nixon didn't have a plan for getting inflation down, and so it caused considerable annoyance that Burns, who seemed to be signing.
One of the things I recall is that, I went back to earlier, where Arthur had presented a very powerful economic strategy to Nixon.
Yeah.
And the part that Nixon didn't follow, well, both parts, he did not control spending. And people would come in and make the case for another $50 million here, $100 million there. Yeah. And gradually, by today's numbers, it doesn't seem very big. But then the deficit, the spending was moving out, and I know Arthur was concerned about that.
Well, but Burns was pushing for tax cuts through 71, even though the administration was negative, so that was later. I think
Arthur had great ideas. I think he had real good political instincts. He not only wanted tax cuts, he to control spending, and he wanted the White House to set the example. And I remember what proposal he made was that the best way to do this would be to have top guys set the example. So the White House should, the president, the White House staff, and the cabinet all take a 10% cut in their salary.
Yes.
And I thought it was a great idea, and I think it would have been terrific. I think he could have done a lot if they'd got that. And what happened, if I remember right, and you have to check the cabinet records, came in and Romney heard about it and decided if 10 was good, he could do it a lot better, and he proposed a 25% cut, which killed the company.
Did he want to kill it? Or?
No, he just enthusiastic.
Carried away.
Just got carried away and said, we got to cut 25% of everyone's salary.
I guess he had money. He had money on his own, probably.
I don't know. So. I don't even know if he did. But Romney, when he got enthusiastic, he didn't think of it. But Arthur had that was one of Arthur's things. Was the idea was, look, we set the example. If we're going to control spending in the federal government, then we take the first kill, which I think is good. Never was done.
Yeah. Burns had a very on-off relationship with the administration. When he felt like after he became Fed chairman, when he felt like his views were not being listened to, he would criticize the administration publicly before the Joint Economic Commission and various sorts of speeches, and especially needled it on the issue of incomes cuts. You became involved in one of those disputes in July of 1971 when Burns criticized the Nixon administration for not being forceful enough on inflation, and apparently then Nixon, that angered him, and he let Charles Colson plan a story in the New York Times, and Burns had asked for a pay raise. Weren't you involved in that? Didn't Burns come to you after that?
Let me just back up because until you brought it up, I had forgotten completely about it. But I left the administration, I believe, in late March of 71. Mm-hmm.
So you could kind of be Arbeiter since you'd already left, and Burns knew you.
Yeah, and now that it comes to mind, there was something, as I said, I'd have to go back and look at files and records, but. Mm-hmm. Which is one of the reasons why I'm trying to do this. But that sounds right, because there was some story, and I do remember now talking to Arthur, where some things were being said that weren't true. And this was, you know, one of the things that Chuck Colson did before he found God.
in talking, as I say, I've just begun to talk to individuals, but in talking to people, particularly economists, the people who worked for him had a lot of admiration for Nixon. He was very able, and economists thought he was very capable in terms of being able to think in terms of wealth trade-offs, cost-benefit analysis, what are the pros and cons, and he could keep track of complicated issues. He was interested in the issues. Would you be at all willing to speculate how a guy that able and that capable could have gotten into the trouble he did with Watergate?
Sure. I think now that the 20 years of political dust has settled, the record is clear. But unfortunately, not many people want to go back and sort of say, well, what really did happen?
Yeah, people want to create a caricature and say,
and
it was all white,
sure,
or all black,
well,
and that's why it's important to think about it, because it was not that way at all.
And the caricature of Watergate is one where the President of the United States is, you know, portrayed as someone who was ruthless and would do anything to win an election, and instructed his boys to go in and rifle the files of the Democratic National Committee to get secret data, and then use the CIA, and then when they got caught, lied, did everything, covered up, and destroyed tapes, etc., etc., etc. There are a number of books out, well, no, two really. One is called Secret Agenda.
It's
secretive agenda? No, secret agenda.
Yeah.
And the other one, everything that came out afterwards, which is built on that one. And the first one was written, was a book, Liberal Democrat reporter, who basically wanted to put the final stake in Nixon's coffin.
Right.
And maybe he's... Oh, the second book is called Silent Coup. Yeah. And use the Freedom of Information Act and started requesting documents from the FBI and various places.
Mm-hmm.
He had to write this definitive work. And as he did so, he discovered that a lot of the papers, the evidence, did not fit what was going on. And he wrote this book called Secret Agenda. And then there's another book came out called Silent Coup, which built on the same basic thesis and expands it. And I think right now, there's no question that Richard Nixon did not order the break-in, did not know about it. Haldeman did not know about it. Ehrlichman did not know about it. Mitchell did not know about it. They were stunned. And it happened. Through a quirk, and I would argue a bit of bad personnel judgment on President Nixon's part, as they started to look into this, the person who was the White House counsel, the normal person look at that, was a guy named John Dean.
Sure.
Who I had gotten to know. He had an office a couple doors down from mine. And I don't think anyone realized the extent to which John Dean was a completely dishonest person. I mean, he would do anything to save his skin, including telling the truth. And the president, you read the tapes and the testimony and so on, basically put him in charge of the investigation. What's going on? And they were given bad information about what was about the extent of what had happened and why it happened. It was a big puzzle. They were missed. And I think that it's very clear that early on they decided it was minor, it was embarrassing, and they did try to cover it up. And once they get in deeper and deeper, and they didn't quite know what they were getting into. And one fellow did know, and it was John Dean.
But you think Mitchell was the Attorney General. Shouldn't he have been the one to make sure that it was...
Oh, sure. There were times when Mitchell used abominable judgment. For example, when Gordon Liddy and John Dean went in and made a presentation as to, you know, how to do opposition research at the convention. You know, I used to do opposition research. What we used to do is to read newspapers and go to the library. And the public records get everything you need. And these, you know, idiots were talking about, you know, hiring prostitutes and putting them on a yacht down in Miami and all kinds of nutty things.
Mm-hmm.
And the Attorney General should have just fired them all right there, but he didn't. Sure. But that's different from ordering the actual break-in and then following through. And I think if you look at the record, there are some... You have to read the two books. I mean, it's a very powerful books, but the reason why most people don't like the books is that it screws up all the preconceived ideas you have about Watergate. And you got to rethink the last 20, 25 years. And it's very messy for most people. They don't like to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But what most people know and believe to be true is simply not true.
Yeah, I talked to...
So, you said, how could he possibly have done that?
Well, I'm not saying... I did not say... How could he have authorized the Watergate burglary?
Okay.
I don't think that's not the way things work.
Oh, right.
This is how could he let it get so far out of hand as to not be.
I think the answer is because he was deliberately misled at a critical time by John Dean.
And you don't think it was also Haldeman and Ehrlichman that were just, they didn't want to tell Nixon how serious it was.
No,
he didn't get the information he needed when he needed it. They wanted to believe that it could be taken care of, but
they
didn't confront him.
Well, no, the way the White House works is that I think that Haldeman and Ehrlichman were misled too. But that's a very tight group, the Haldeman, Nixon, Ehrlichman apparatus. And everyone kind of forgets that while all this is going on, these guys are trying to run the government. and they're dealing with the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I remember that.
Holland's got a million things to do.
Yeah, nobody wanted to hear about that part of it, even though they tried to tell about it. I can remember that at the end.
No. And as I said, if you read these two books, Silent Coup and Secret Agenda, which is very hard to get now, by the way, you may not be able to find it, and then the Silent Coup, read them one and then the next one. I think at least it makes it understandable how a smart, tough person like Nixon could get into this mess. And I mean, and he admits that it was a mess.
Yeah.
Sure.
And how did you back into politics in the Reagan administration? Were you involved in the campaign?
It's not that I feel that way. It's that I got the papers and the evidence to show that that's exactly the way it happened. It was all written out, down, spoken, laid out on the public record.
Would you be willing to tell me your story again? About Reagan's first encounter with Paul Volcker.
Oh, that one, yeah. Okay, well, jumping up a little bit ahead. I forget the exact date, but shortly after Reagan took office, he systematically set out and went up the hill and met with congressmen, he met with the congressional leaders, and he was going to visit the Supreme Court, and had this idea, well, why don't you go over and visit the Federal Reserve? And I think we all thought it was a good idea. But when it was proposed to Paul Volcker, he was quite apprehensive about it. I think he was just basically concerned about the propriety of the president going over, what it looked like was compromising the integrity and independence of the Fed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And the traditional thing had been for the chairman of the Fed to be summoned to the White House. Well, but that wasn't Reagan's style. So we went back and forth, and I don't know who worked it out. But the final resolution was that there would be a lunch at Secretary of Treasury Don Regan's office over in the Treasury Building. And it was a very unusual lunch. I remember that day is that Reagan decided to walk over. And I remember, and there were some of the people there, I think, let's see. Ed Meese was at the lunch, and Jim Baker, and David Stockman. Probably Murray Weidenbaum, too, if he was on board at the time. Anyways, we walked out the front door of the White House, off the Pennsylvania Avenue, and turned right, and headed on right down to the Treasury Building with the Secret Service running along, and people kind of startled at the real live president walking around outside on a nice day. And, by the way, the Secret Service convinced me, I don't think you ever do that again. So we got there, and it was a nice lunch, and just the president sitting at the head of the table, and Volcker, I believe, was sitting to his right. And I recall, as we sat down, within a few seconds, the president sat down, turned and looked around the table, and looked straight at Volcker and said, you know, he said something about, I've been wondering, he said, during the campaign, he said, I sometimes get questions and I get letters, and why do we need a Federal Reserve System at all? And it was a serious question. And for a few seconds, Volcker was absolutely, he had been smoking a cigar and his jaw dropped, and was, a look of disbelief. And then he realized that he was not being kidded, that this was a serious question, and that if he didn't answer it real well, it might not be a Federal Reserve. So he took a few deep breaths and came back and gave, within a few minutes, the most eloquent defense of the Federal Reserve System I've ever heard. It was very nicely done. And the President Reagan listened and said, it's okay. And then we went on to discuss other things.
So it's your impression that then that Reagan basically left the Federal Reserve System alone? While he was president,
sure,
because he agreed that with Volcker that we needed to get inflation rate down. That was part of the Volcker was doing it.
Well, that wasn't. There was a higher reason. We had some internal debates. One lesson I had learned well from Arthur Burns, and also at the time, also I don't want to forget this. Arthur Burns was a major part of the Reagan campaign. I had another piece of paper I wanted to give you.
This was how we put together the economic policy for the campaign. And one of the things we had during the 80 campaign, we had something like 40, 45 different policy task forces set up working. We had about 640 intellectuals. We had a real army, which the press didn't pay much attention to. But anyways, in economics, which we thought was the key, we had six separate economic policy task forces and one overall economic policy coordinating committee. So, for example, the budget task force was chaired by Alan Greenspan, the inflation policy by Paul McCracken, international monetary was chaired by Arthur Burns.
Maybe I could get a photocopy of that.
No, I'm going to give you the whole thing. Regulatory reform, Murray Weidenbaum. Spending control, Caspar Weinberger. Tax policy, Charlie Walker. And Michael Boskin was the second member. Then on the
star cast.
On the coordinating committee of the whole thing, which coordinated in the six, each chairman of the six task forces was a member of the coordinating committee. Plus, Milton Friedman, Jack Kemp, James Lynn, and then George Shultz was the chairman of the whole thing. And then during the transition, after Reagan had become was the president-elect, and this I described this in the book Revolution Day. One of the things I suggested was that my old friend Dick Allen, who was then become a National Security Advisor, he was resurrecting the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, which had been started under Jack Kennedy. Well, sorry, under Eisenhower, but very important under Kennedy. And it was the idea to bring in a group of private individuals to advise on and give advice on overall intelligence policy. So I looked at that and I thought that, so I borrowed his executive order and recreated and suggested we also set up the President's Economic Policy Advisory Board. Have a group of outside economists who would come in and sit down and directly advise the President on the economic policy. And that was opposed mightily by the Secretary of the Treasury, Chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers, and the head of OMB.
That's the
Reagan, Weidenbaum, and Stockman.
That's the group that Friedman would come in on and talk to.
Exactly. And
you thought they would dilute their influence? It doesn't seem, seems hardly like
What?
You aren't ordinarily afraid of a bunch of academic economists.
No. This is a very different vision. This is George Shultz, Milton Friedman, Alan Greenspan, Arthur Burns.
Not your ordinary set of academic.
They were terrified.
You can see why.
And because these are people who came in as almost peer of the president, had no vested interest, no institutional interest, and were certainly not shy about laying out their views with great force.
That's for sure.
And were not even shy about criticizing people. I mean, because Bill Simon was a member. You had
none of these were exactly your shrinking violet.
No, and these are people who had been chair of the Fed, who had run Secretary of the Treasury, who had been chairman of the Council, and had done it better. You see, than there. Well, that does. And what happened? It was interesting. It was a very powerful group because that first year, when the policy that had been set during the campaign and locked in the transition. When there were deviations, for example, I remember Stockman and Don Reagan would get quite upset as the deficit started to widen. We had to postpone the tax policy. And basically what I would do is get on and put a phone call into George Shultz to say, it may be a good idea to have a meeting. And he would call a meeting, we would come in. We did this six times the first year. And call all this group in, and they would sit down in the Roosevelt Room, and meet for a couple hours from 9 or 11. And the door would open up, and President Reagan would walk in. And very unusually, he'd walk in, and he
liked this group of people. He thought these are fun. This was his private advisory group who gave him straight advice.
Now, Don Reagan, Stockman, and Weidenbaum, they were all sitting there. But he would come in, and he would usually, wink at Milton Friedman and go over and
shakes hands with Arthur and laugh and giggle and talk to George Shultz and to Bill Simon. And they were old friends.
Sure.
And then George Shultz, as chairman, would take about 10 minutes and sum up everything that had been discussed and say, bing, 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 bing. And then they'd open it up. And the president would say what he felt, and they would say, "Am I? I've got notes that I kept during the meetings." And basically, the basic what this group did, they said, "Look, you know what you're doing in terms of economic strategy is exactly right. Stick by it. This is terrific." And they reinforced tremendously what President Reagan was doing that first year. And I would argue, and I know this is no one else is paying attention, but if it hadn't been for that group, I don't think you would have gotten this economic plan done. Because the way the institution works, people were getting shaky.
Yeah.
Now, with coming back, starting out with this, with Volcker, the basic attitude about the Fed, there were some people internally were arguing, "Oh my God, you know, the Fed is too tight."
It was tight. Yeah.
But the predominant view was, and Burns was a very, very strong exponent of this, was, look, leave the Federal Reserve alone. This is an independent group. Do not try to lecture them or talk to them, et cetera, et cetera.
Hmm.
That was the first thing. Leave them alone. And, you know, for a good ethical reason, and second, as a practical reason, if you do try to fool around and change them, then they will probably do just the opposite. So leave them alone. They're okay. And then periodically, Volcker would come over and meet with President. I remember during the first year, I used to attend some of the meetings. They'd go and sit down. Basically, it was just a very friendly meeting. They'd laugh and joke a little bit. And Volcker would give him information, what was happening, summing it up, and so on. He would ask a few questions, but never did Volcker try to, you know, say, "Here's what you should do in fiscal policy," or never did the president say, "Well, you know, you should go easier in rates," or anything like that. It was a very careful separation. And I think a lot of that was due to Arthur Burns' influence as the former chairman of the Fed, now saying this is how it should be done. In fact, I'd love to go back to my file, because I think I even recall some way when there was the debate really started to heat up about, we've got to try to influence the Fed, and then Arthur stepped in. Couldn't swear that.
August of 81 was when interest rates, federal funds rate, got up around 21%. So that was enormously restrictive. And even then, your recollection is that Reagan was willing to let the Fed trust its judgment.
And this was something which was agreed in this, in you know, the people who were really involved in politics, whether it was Ed Meese, Michael Deaver, Jim Baker.
Mm-hmm.
They all had that basic idea of, look, leave it alone. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was, you know, working properly. The only thing I remember that we used to have the first year, there was they normally have a troika. We had a quadriennial. It was every Tuesday morning. We met for breakfast at Reagan's office. Reagan, Stockton, Rubenbaum, and myself. I went over, the week went over to where the economic policy was. And I think the only problem they had with monetary policy is that it was screwing up their projections. That inflation was coming down much faster than anyone thought. And on the one hand, everyone was very sort of delighted and pleased. This is terrific. Look at, you know, everything is coming down. And on the other hand, Stockman was going crazy. He said, "Look, this is not producing revenue here. I've got a problem."
Right. Yeah.
And as budget director, he had a problem. And I think he was primarily concerned with how he looked as budget director.
So at this time, the criticisms that people like Paul Craig Roberts were making of the Fed for torpedoing supply side economics and torpedoing the projections that the budget would come back into balance on its own, and blaming the Fed for that. That all came later. That that was
there were a lot of people in the press writing all kinds of stories. I mean, you had Jude Winiski and those people saying that they were running the thing and they were doing this, and people were getting suspicious and paranoid and all kinds of things that were being said. What I would argue is that you really got to be careful of the press reports, because what you had was a press dominated by left-wing liberals, no question. 80 to 85% of the reporters, maybe more, could be staff members of the Democratic National Committee. And they were horrified at what had happened. There was this cowboy in their midst that had taken over. And the rascal was doing these things. And the Democrats were just going crazy. So there was a lot of misinformation that was getting put forth. So you almost got to go back and say, okay, look, who was he talking to? And in terms of economic policy, it's very simple. I'd say there were three levels of advisors. The first, important levels. The lowest level was the staff. Secretary of the Treasury, Chairman of the Council, head of OMB. The second level, in terms of overall strategy, was this outside economic group that came in. And there was just no contest. When there was a disagreement between, on the one side, Don Regan and Stockman, and on the other side, Arthur Burns and George Shultz and Milton Friedman and Bill Simon, the president knew who was right.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And then the third level is the president. And everyone forgets that when he was at Eureka College, he majored in economics, he knew the basics of economics. When we were traveling in the plane in the campaign discussing things, he felt very comfortable in economics. He had no problems with basic policies. He liked to refine them, but he was very much his own economist. Someday I'd love to go back and find out what book he used at Eureka. But he had it down pretty good. Didn't he?
Well, it's been very helpful and very interesting, especially the last the insights into policy making in the Reagan administration. I've not heard that. So that's
it ruins a lot of good theories as to how it was done. I mean, this is, for example, there is this one thing. I've got a paperback version of this revolution. I'll give you a copy because I got some promotion copies. But for example, there was this great myth that spread all over the country about Reagan all running around and talking, all you have to do is cut tax rates and get more revenue right away. That was nonsense. I mean, and I just describe in the book how I call people who had put that out, like Marty Feldstein and Alan Blinder. Who are the other ones? And, I wanted to read something for you.
Let me give you an example of the kind of stuff that's out there.
Yeah, start down at the bottom there. Let me